Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 428. This week on the program, I've got something really, really special. If I told you that I had on Emperor Palpatine as a guest, would you believe me? In a way, I do. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. I've also got a great article, and we will get right into the education right after some quick news. I want to thank everybody out there who is assisting us with the production of the show. So right off the bat, thank you to all of our producers, fellows, and contributors. Secondly, I did solidify the topic and the date. On January 28th, I will be at Lodge Vitruvian 767 in Indianapolis, Indiana. And then after that, I'll be doing the Ark and Freemasonry. And so I launched a new historical talk. It's also a symbolic talk, I suppose. And if you're interested, reach out and we'll schedule a time for it. But the name of a new talk that I'm doing is called They Know Not What They Do, The Esoteric Freemason's Uninformed Obsession with C.W. Ledbetter. The piece really explores the timeline of theosophy, and specifically, C.W. Ledbetter, many people aren't familiar with the man, really. So what I do in this presentation is we kind of go through that. It will be a research paper that'll be released in the Illinois Lodge of Research. I've actually got a couple interviews lined up with heads of some organizations who are going to talk to me about it so that I can add even more information into the research. So keep that in mind if you're looking for something interesting, and if I do say so, it is of a mature topic. So the first piece that I have for you this week is actually something that I don't even have to read to you. I got a message earlier this week that was from a brother, Adam Wolf. And Adam Wolf said to me that he listens to the show and he wanted to reach out because he assisted in the production of a poem that Brother Brian D. Dietrich wrote called The Lost Word. And that poem was read by legendary character actor and Culver City Fauchet past master Clive Selsby Revel. And so Clive, he has tons of stuff behind him, but what many people instantly know him from is the voice of Emperor Palpatine in Empire Strikes Back. So I would love to get into this right now. All right, so as we get into this, I need to give credit where credit is due. What's been told to me is this recording stemmed from part of Culver City Fauchet Lodge's esoteric lecture series where they brought in Brother Brian D. Dietrich to read his poem, The Lost Word, that was first published in the Philalethes, the Journal of Masonic Research, volume number 64, number 3 in 2014. Culver City Fauchet Lodge, number 467, assembled their talents and decided to record the poem with none other than its own worshipful Clive Selsby Revel, past master. The project was produced by worshipful Brother Curtis Schumacher, past master, and worshipful Adam W. Wolf, past master, and with the sound engineering of Mike Spreer, and the CD art design was by worshipful Brother Sam House. Now, the art for the CD will be kind of tucked into the show notes, so I will definitely ask you to check the show notes out so that you can see even more about where this comes from. Just a little bit about Brother Clive Revel. Was born on the 18th of April, 1930, is a New Zealand-born character actor best known for his roles in musical theater and performance on the London stage. His career included Shakespearean theater, noting roles in Hamlet, Love's Labor Lost, The Merchant of Venice, Julius Caesar, and The Tempest. American works have included playing Mr. Pickwick in The Pickwick Papers as his Broadway debut, and others following, including Irma LaDuce, The Incomparable Max and Oliver. His career has also involved television appearances spanning from Gilbert and Sullivan productions with the BBC, to guest starring roles with such American series as Columbo, Heart to Heart, Dynasty, Magnum P.I., The Love Boat, Remington Steele, Murder, She Wrote. His compelling voice has placed him with such productions as the original 1980s version of Star Wars Episode V, The Empire Strikes Back, in which he voiced Emperor Palpatine, and animated cartoons such as The Transformers and Batman the Animated Series. Clive Selby Revel, Passmaster, is a prominent Freemason, having served actively within the Masonic community and as a master of Culver City Fauché Lodge No. 467, Free and Accepted Masons of California. I present to you The Lost Word by Brian D. Dietrich and read and performed by Clive Selby Revel, Passmaster.
Lost Word by Brian Dietrich. Whitman died, chasing Chantillon, seeking grammar for God, a uniform hieroglyphic, American answers were Egyptian enigmas. Still, he found no stone, no Virginia Rosetta, dead language, dead union, leaves of grace. From Humboldt's humble hunch, to Grimm's lout of a Schiebung, to Chomsky's mysterious miracle, we seek first clause, the name of he who names. And Adam? No. What logic was ever uttered in Eden? Do not eat, said the seraphim. Do not partake of this knowledge, this that would make you obey. You should not know what not is not for you. Do not eat, do not, and burn with desire. Do, and burn with despite. Boethius in his cell, Socrates on his couch. Aristotle, Aristarchus, Beauvoir, Beauregard, all sought solace in symmetry, argument, artifice, art, in the desert of the real. Suppose Saussure got rhetoric right. Here, look for where it begins, where a saying starts. Posit unknown from known, and watch the signs signify what you never intended. Publish what you never published. Argue what others only ever said you said. No. Begin again without yourself, with yourself only signified, referent to nothing. Imagine nothing. Argue even after death, after silence, always after that. Provide. Provide. Bakhtin knew, and Barthes, Eco, and Foucault. There is no general course. Nothing but everything outside the cave. The lingering linguistics of longing. Velikovsky wanted something out of nothing, too. Wanted Jupiter, Dieu, Pitar, God, Father, this and Venus fully formed from his brow. Wanted it so much he made it out of math. Wanted equations proving the planets, pong, spat forth from storm and eye, his imagined protoplanet zigzagged through our solar system, passing sister Earth, parting the Red Sea, dropping manna. None of this, of course, happened. Except it did on paper, on papyrus, among the numbers of the many means of God. So, geometry also. Not just grammar or logic, rhetoric or arithmetic. There are always other roads. Remember, Escher drew us into the plain, made the stairs that take us where all stairs should go, bridged our absence where nothing becomes something, becomes nothing again. Dimensions divided, angles arbitrated, hand drawing hand etching images of enzymes and ants, geese and gravitas. Humanity and infinity, the romance of reflection. We are the shapes that shake us. We shape the shaped us. But having no end, owning no original arc, we lose ourselves in the labyrinth, looking, always looking, mounting the stair, modeling Möbius, moving across the great girth of Earth's grid, plotting, rising, falling, always falling into formula. Finally, there is Mozart. Mozart and Drake. We could mention so many, humanity's long lineage of making meaning of the moans the moon makes, spinning seas up from darkness, spitting us forth, calling us home. Musicians and astronomers. All the madmen and the maimed. All trying to mutter the music of the spheres. Mozart plucked it down to play as performance. Drake made maths out of why we might pluck it all. Mozart gave voice to the wolf, to the hour when the stars speak, when our souls seek anything but silence, everything as silence. Drake defined the size and scope of said silence, said likely we have never been alone. The number of communicating civilizations in the galaxy, the number of other souls, the sheer volume of possible answers to our ancient arrogance, our quixotic questions, the name of the being who best knows God. Even if the number is a fraction of a trillion, the number of stars we see most close about us, this galaxy, this home, if the number is even the smallest part of 300 sextillion stars saturating the larger unseen scope of sky, all we know and don't know, if they too have planets, which they will, if they too have seekers, which they will, if they too have Huygens, Hawkings, Shakespeares, Saussures, Golems, Grimms, Mondrians, and Mozarts, and Masons, which they will, they too will have sought all that is not, all that is. They too will have waited for the word, carved in bone, in sandstone, in gnarl and gneiss. They too will have hollowed out caves at their version of Karnak and Kalanash, Jericho and Jeju Island, Turabong and Toposiris temples. Always temples to the word. But what is it, this word we seek, this emptiness nothing seems to satiate? What I am? What I am not? From Chauvet to Chartres, from Tantan to Berekat Ram, to Teotihuacan, nothing becomes the something we desire. Desire becomes reason to reanimate all matter that matters. Golem, God particle, golden record. We put our words between ourselves and that which we cannot name. Holy of Holies, JHVHINRIACTG. Seti. Letters. Always letters on the face of the deep. Christ carving his word in the dirt. A code to keep the craven at bay. Cain on his knees at the watering hole, washing, a sign unutterable, a stain that will not but stay. A rabbi entering the temple, God's name aflame on a tongue he dare not wag. And the temple at Karnak, a name spoken to bring back the sun. The loci screaming it, eternal in the dark, in pain, beneath the brunt of everything earth. And Yeats, turning and turning to nothing in his nodding tower, and Crowley, levelling law, and everyone. Bradbury channeling childhood from the stars, Melville scribbling spotless as a lamb, Eliot shoring up ruins, Rushdie and Lessing and Lovecraft and dear dead Dostoevsky, everyone. Clemens to Clark, Dante to Dickinson, Faulkner, last man on this doomed dark rock, Einstein, Ellison, Edison, Morrison, Quill to Kinetoscope, Pumice to Papyrus, Gutenberg to Gettysburg, to Googled Gleeze. We have made our marks, made our signs, sent them sailing, soaring, failing into the night. What words? All words. All but the one we have sought. All but the right word, the one we lost before the rest. The name of the one who made us. Laid us brick by brick, set us on the level, encompassed our corners, rounded what was rough, set square that which strayed, the one who tamped us, tested us, smiled upon us, deep as the deepest temple. The one who beveled all that cannot be altered. Alter, psalter, stare, infinite author of our inner path. Origin of everything more, everything or. Article, particle, core, more, more light. At the center of all, before that first, last, best disaster, we seek it fast. We seek it faster. We seek our master.
All right, now I don't know where to even begin with this. If that wasn't one of the coolest things you've ever heard, I don't know what is. Now, of course, my immense gratitude goes out to Brother Adam Wolf and the entire team who put this together. And what a performance and reading by worshipful Brother Clive Selsby. Now, this is a copywritten work by Brian D. Dietrich. And he maintains these rights to his performance. Brian D. Dietrich is a noted poet and scholar, recipient of the Paris Review's Poetry Prize, and multiple nominees for the Pulitzer Prize. He is a chair of the Division of Arts and Letters at Newman University and is a member of Albert Pike Lodge No. 303 in Wichita, Kansas. thank you, Culver City Fauché Lodge. Next, I wanted to continue maybe the theme of Star Wars. This is not a Star Wars episode, but it just kind of was interesting that it turned out that way. As many times that happens, I receive an email and get turned on to something really interesting. Well, this week was no different. Now, a couple years ago, when I was on my way down to the Grand Lodge sessions in early October, we were on our way back when I met a conductor of the train who just happened to be a brother who had listened to the show quite a few times. This is Brother Daniel Hogan. Daniel Hogan has a brilliant mind and from time to time shares some gems with me that he goes into. And I'd like to share, I asked him if I could share this email with you all, and he said, sure, no, not a problem. So I'd like to share his email. He said, Brother Robert, I was listening to the last couple episodes of Ex Oriente, and they caused me to do some etymological research. So etymological research is essentially the research to where a word came from, and it breaks it down by the time that it was released and the way people used it then. He says, then today, when I was listening to the most recent episode of the Masonic Roundtable, John joked about replacing So Moted Be with This Is the Way. Well, that joke played right into the etymology work I did a few days ago. Not sure if you watched The Mandalorian or have seen the most recent Star Wars or not, but this might have some spoilers. Well, that's your guys' spoiler alert right there. Although, as I read through this, I'm not sure how many spoilers are in here, so listen at your own risk. He says, into the Star Wars stuff, and remember, spoilers ahead. I was told by a Greek Orthodox priest years ago what my name means. El is Hebrew for God, or at least it is one of the many words that means God. Daniel comes from the root words din and El. So the name Daniel translates to, God is my judge. In the final episode of The Mandalorian, it is revealed that Mando's name is Djarin. Let's break that name down. Din, judge, Hebrew. The last name is a little harder to break down because the first letter is a D, but it's not impossible. Let's assume the D is simply there to keep it from being a hard J, or is there for aesthetics. Either way, we are going to ignore it because it makes things more difficult. We are also going to assume the elements of the name are from different languages. In Star Wars, and there isn't necessarily any rhyme or reason to names, so it is a fair assumption that names could be comprised of different linguistic elements. Ja is equal to born, so Sanskrit. Rin is equal to dignified, severe, and cold in Japanese. So the last name could mean born dignified or born cold. These could be representative of his transition in the series. After all, it does start out on an ice planet. Born could also mean bear, a verb, to bear something. So Din Djarin's name could mean judge born dignified severe cold. It could also mean judge bearing dignity, severity, or coldness. So again, it could be representative of his transition from a cold bounty hunter to a more dignified and deliberate judge of character of right and wrong. Or maybe Baby Yoda, quote-unquote, represents dignity, severity, coldness, and therefore Mando is a judge bearing or having possession of Baby Yoda. His initials are D.D., which could be D.D., which means straight or rightly, in Dagbani, or it could be Didi, as in D-I-D-I, a diminutive of Dieter, which means warrior of the people in its Germanic roots. That got me to thinking about other characters. Rey is a derivative of Ray, which means a beam of light. Palpatine can be broken down into Pal, Pat, Een. Pal is a variation of Paul, which is Latin and means small. Pat is a variation of Patrick, which in Latin means nobleman. Een simply gives more emphasis. So Rey Palpatine means beam of light from a small nobleman. Kylo Ren is another fun one. Ren means love in Japanese, so the Knights of Ren could be translated to Knights of Love, but the Japanese root could give some indication of the samurai or ninja type appearance to the Knights of Ren. Now, if you look up quote-unquote love as a name, it is Swedish for Louis. Louis is a Latinized form of Ludwig, and Ludwig has a Germanic meaning of famous battle. Kylo may be derived from the Latin calum, which means sky. So put it all together, and Kylo Ren means sky battle or star war. His etymology source is behindthename.com. So, again, he never disappoints with some great research, and he gets his mind reeling. And this is really what we all should be doing, you know, in regards to any Masonic topic. Just dive in and go looking and see what you can find. He said he's sure it will cause a spirited debate among the Star Wars fans that listen. So, my thanks once more to Brother Dan. Thank you. All right, now before we move on to the article for this week, let's pay the bills. How do we make this show happen? I ask that every week. My friend and brother Adam said that. But anyway, you can support this show by heading over to wcypodcast.com, and you can check it out. We've got ways to support the show on a monthly basis or a one-time gift. So you can become a producer through Patreon, becoming a contributor by donating $2 a month, and that'll get your name on our website. You can donate $5 a month, which makes you a fellow, and as a fellow, you'll get the name on the website, plus I'm going to send you a personal card in the mail that I'll fill out, and I'll sign it, and thank you for supporting the program. And if you're a producer at the $10 level a month, I will go ahead and send you the card with a pin, the producer's pin, and your name on the site. And you can do the same thing on PayPal. We've got the same three ways to support the show: contributor, fellow, producer. And of course, if you are so inclined, you could make a one-time gift through PayPal. And you can also do that through Patreon as well. You just have to click that when you go through the links. So aside from that, we also have a few things on the shop. We have the producer's pin that you can purchase. We have, I think, one Mason's Lady decal left. Also, right now, I am 100% out of the It's Business Time book that I can sign and send to you. So I'll have to order some more, and once I get those in, we'll be able to start shipping them. But feel free to order, and I'll just have to ship it when I get it. And then, of course, we have Laudable Pursuit from Audible. Myself and a few of my Lodge brothers got together, and we produced Laudable Pursuit on audiobook, thanks to the illustrious brother Chris Hodapp and the Knights of the North for their kindness in allowing us to tribute their work in such a way. We don't make any money. This doesn't really belong under supporting this show, but if you would help support the Indiana Library Masonic Museum, all the proceeds from Laudable Pursuit, the Audible book, go right back to them. So when Audible pays me, I just write a check and I send it over to them, and we'll help them out. Other ways you can support this show is through the bookstore. For the first time ever, we have a bookstore where all of our books by those who've been on the show are listed, and you can click on the links and go right to Amazon and buy them, and Amazon throws us a few pennies, literally pennies, but it's better than what we used to do, which was just link you to Amazon and get nothing. So we get a few pennies if you shop through our links, which is really cool of them to do. Lastly, we have Our Friends. You can visit Franklin's Fortune. Use the promo code WCY to get $5 off your order. It's a great strategic card game that you play with your family. Recommended 14 and up, but really, I've got my kids. I've been telling you guys for a while. They were playing at 10 years old, and they love it. The other thing we have, of course, is the Great Books Program. The Great Books Program right now is closed in enrollment. So if you have not signed up now, you can't get in. But if you click on Get Started when you get into their website, fill out the form, and you'll receive a portion of the reading list and a summary of Mortimer J. Adler's How to Read a Book. And you'll be on their VIP waiting list and get priority registration access at the next enrollment period, which will just be a couple months. But if you, again, if you use that promo code when you do sign up, WCY, you're going to get a significant discount. You get 25% off your first 3 months. That's huge. All right. So that's it. We paid the bills. Thanks for listening or fast-forwarding or listening at double time while I pay the bills. But now we're going to get into the article for this week. All right, our next piece is continuing on with an ongoing fascination I have with something called the Two Pillars. Listeners of this program will know that I have devoted several episodes to reading papers about the Two Pillars in the Temple of Solomon, their symbology, their architecture, their antiquity, what they represent from system to system, and by system I mean wisdom school to wisdom school, so whether that's Freemasonry or Golden Dawn or Alpha Omega or Theosophy or whatever, there's always the Two Pillars, right? Kabbalah, etc. So I wanted to read one, and I had to search our archive to make sure I hadn't read this one before, and it doesn't look like I have, and I read it the first time and I thought, I don't think this is familiar, so this should be new for everyone, and so let's get right into that. Two Pillars, A Short Talk Bulletin, Volume Number 13, September 1935, Number 9, by Unknown. Few references in Freemasonry are less understood than the two brazen pillars in the porch of King Solomon's Temple. Probably a greater mass of misinformation exists regarding these than any other symbol in the craft. Early ritualists confused the mythical pillars of stone spoken of in almost all the old charges or manuscript constitutions of the craft with the brazen pillars of the porch. The result is that modern Freemasons have composite pillars fusing of the ancient and the mythical pillars on which were supposed to be engraved the arts and sciences of the time before the flood, and those which Hiram Abiff erected undoubtedly with Egyptian influences and memories of Egyptian temples to guide him before the great house of the Lord, which Solomon built. The fascinating, if wholly legendary, history of the craft, repeated with the variations in the majority of the old manuscript rolls, beginning with the Regis of 1390, is older than any Freemasonry we know in practice. The story varies from manuscript to manuscript, but in its essentials is much the same. It was evidently a tradition as strong in its day as is our legend of Hiram. To quote but a line bearing on the pillars, consider these words from the York Manuscript No. 1, written about CE 1600. Before Noah flood, there was a man called Lamech, as is written in the scriptures of Yea Charter of Genesis. And this Lamech had two wives, yea one named Adah, by whom he had two sons, yea one named Jabel and the other named Jubal. And his other wife was called Zillah, by whom he had one son named Tubal-Cain and one daughter named Naamah. And these four children founded yea beginnings of all yea sciences in yea world. Jabel, yea oldest son, found out yea science of geometry. He was a keeper of flocks and sheep lands in the fields, as it is noted in yea chapter before. And his brother Jubal found yea science of music, song of the tongue and harp and organ. And yea third brother Tubal-Cain found yea science called smithcraft, or gold, silver, iron, copper, and steel. And yea daughter found yea science of weaving. And these persons, knowing right well that God would take vengeance for sin, either by fire or water, wherefore they writ their several sciences that they had found in two pillars of stone that might be found after Noah his flood, and yea one stone would not burn with fire, and yea other, called laterns, because it would not drown with water. End quote. The word here spelled laterns, L-T-E-R-N-E-S, is rendered on the other old constitutions as laterns, usually translated to brick. But marble does not resist fire. Brick, especially earthly, unscientifically vitrified brick, does not resist water. If the word be considered a perversion of Latin, which means brass or bronze, then the ancient legendary pillars are made of metal and marble, a more sensible idea, since metal would resist fire and marble water. In Tyre was the great temple of Heracles, with two pillars, one of gold, the other of smaragdus or polished green marble. Other Tyrian temples to Melkarth had two metal pillars or two monoliths. Modern masonry has hollow pillars to serve as safe repositories for the quote-unquote archives of masonry, and to preserve them from flood and fire, in spite of the fact that sacred history says nothing of masonry or the reason for the pillars being hollow. It is reasonable to suppose that the ancient Masonic tradition of Lamech's children and their pillars was confused as knowledge of the Bible became more common after the invention of printing, with other quote-unquote brazen pillars of the ancient day, and finally with those of Solomon's temple. How high were the pillars? A question which has agitated American Freemasonry largely without reason for many years. A majority of American rituals state that they were 35 cubits in height, a minority hold 18, one compromised on 30, a few do not give height at all. Mackey, Revised Encyclopedia of Freemasonry, says, quote, "Immediately, within the porch of the temple and on each side of the door were placed two hollow brazen pillars, the height of each was 27 feet, and the diameter about 6 feet, and the thickness of the brass 3 inches. Above the pillar, and covering its upper part to the depth of 9 inches, was an oval body or chapiter 7 feet and a half in height. Springing out from the pillar at the junction of the chapiter with it was a row of lotus petals, which, first spreading around the chapiter, afterwards gently curved downward toward the pillar, something like the acanthus leaves on the capital of a Corinthian column. About 2/5 of the distance from the bottom of the chapiter, or just below its most bulging part, a tissue of network was carved, which extended over its whole upper surface. To the bottom of this network was suspended a series of fringes, and then again were carved two rows of pomegranates, 100 being in each row." End quote. This description, it seemed to Dr. Mackey, is the only one that can be reconciled with the various passages which relate to these pillars in the books of Kings, Chronicles, and Josephus, to give a correct conception of the architecture of these symbols. In 1904, Brother John W. Barry of Iowa, later to become Grand Master, rendered an exhaustive report to his Grand Lodge on the height of the pillars, proving anew the belief, practically accepted by biblical students, that 35 dimension is that of both pillars together, the actual height of each being 18 cubits. The confusion arises in the two accounts in Chronicles and Kings. Various explanations have been advanced as to the discrepancy between 35 as the height of each. The missing cubit is explained on the theory that, while actually each pillar, from root to summit, was 18 cubits, only 17 and one-half showed, the rest being hidden in the chapiter and base. This explanation apparently began with the Genevan Bible, or the Breeches Bible, in which is a marginal note stating of the pillars, quote, "Everyone was 18 cubits long, but half cubit could not be seen, for it was hid in the round denef of the chapiter, and therefore only viewable was every 17 and a half," end quote. To know the quote-unquote actual size of the pillars, it is necessary to know the length of a cubit. And here is room for speculation and many authorities. The Abingdon Bible commentaries say that, quote-unquote, "the common cubit equal to about 18 inches, the longer royal cubit to about 20 and a half inches." John Wesley Kletchner, whose restorations of King Solomon's temple are to be found in Masonic Bibles, considered the cubit to be equal to 2 feet. The Standard Dictionary gives the cubit as a measure of length determined by the average arm from elbow to middle fingertip. The Britannica considers that the temple cubit must have been in excess of 25 inches. Canon J.W. Horsley, past Grand Chaplain, England, who has studied and written much upon the pillars, gives a table of sizes in which the cubit is but 14 2/5 inches. Many rituals set forth the fact that Hiram cast the pillars on the plains of Jordan in the clay grounds between Succoth and Zarthan, or Zeredatha. But 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles are authority for the statement. But if there ever existed a quote-unquote clay ground in the location specified, it has disappeared and left no trace. Explorations, Lynch in 1847, Ridgway in 1874, not only found no clay ground, but no trace of smelters, furnaces, or other means of melting and casting brass. The point is of little importance, The pillars and the temple vessels were cast somewhere, but a failure of fact in a statement so absolute may be an indication. The other 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles statements about the pillars were also inaccurate as to facts. Vide the height statements. The globe celestial and terrestrial, which usually surmount American lodge room pillars, are wholly modern inventions, without basis in scriptural fact. Somewhere, at some time, some ritual maker confused the spherical form of the chapiter with an additional sphere. Desiring to account for it, he drew a map of the world on one and a map of the heavens on the other. But in the Kings and Chronicles accounts and in Josephus, there are no mentions of celestial and terrestrial globes. All this is more interesting than important. The symbolical meaning of the pillars is the vital matter to Freemasons. In the eyes of critical scholarship, the ancient meaning was of the might and majesty of deity. From the dawn of religion, the pillar, monolith, or built up, has played an important part of the worship of the unseen. From the huge boulders of Stonehenge, among which the Druids are supposed to have performed their rites, through East Indian temples to the religion of ancient Egypt, scholars trace the use of pillars as an essential part of the religious worship. Indeed, in Egypt, the obelisk stood for the very presence of the sun god himself. The ancient believed the earth to be flat, and that it was supported by pillars, by two pillars of God, placed at the western entrance of the world as then known. These are now called Gibraltar, on the one side of the strait, and Quetta, on the other. Some writers have suggested that the pillars represent the masculine and feminine elements in nature, others that they stand for authority of church and state, because on stated occasions the high priest stood before one pillar and the king before the other. Some students think that they allude to the two legendary pillars of Enoch, upon which traditions inform us all the wisdom of the ancient world was inscribed in order to preserve it, from inundations and conflagrations. William Preston supposed that by them Solomon had referred to the pillars of cloud and fire which guided the children of Israel out of the bondage and into the promised land. One authority says, a literal translation of their names is, quote, "In thee is strength, and it shall be established," and by a natural transposition may thus be expressed, "O Lord, thou art almighty, and thy power is established from everlasting to everlasting." Quoting Abingdon again, the fact that each pillar had a particular name further suggests that they were not simply a part of the architectural adornment, but originally bore some analogy to the pillars which, singly or in pairs, formed an important feature of the Semitic sanctuaries. At Melkart's shrine at Tyre there were, according to Herodotus, two costly obelisks, at which Melkart and probably his wife and consort was worshipped. Two pillars also stood before the temple in Paphos and in Hierapolis. Ashurbanipal, on the occasion of his expedition to Egypt and Ethiopia, recounts that part of his spoil included two obelisks high with resplendent plating of fine workmanship from the threshold of the gate of the temple. Therefore, these pillars at Jerusalem, built like the temple itself by Phoenician workmen, were probably intended to be symbols of the deity. They were an artistic refinement of the mezubah, or stone obelisk, which, at many Israelist sanctuaries, still stood beside the altar in much latter days. But it does not necessarily follow that Solomon and his subjects so interpreted the significance of these novel and foreign brass objects. For them, the ark in the oracle seemed to have symbolized Jehovah. But it is possible that instead of Jachin, Jehovah was carved on one pillar by Hiram and subsequently altered into his name, and Boaz, in him is strength, may be later substitution for Tammuz, whose cult was very prevalent in the Semitic world. The entered apprentice, in the process of being passed to the degree of fellowcraft, passes between the pillars. No hint is given that he should pass nearer to one than the other. No suggestion is made that he either may work a greater influence than the other. He merely passes between. A deep significance is in this very omission. Masons refer to the promise of God unto David. The interested may read chapter 7 of 2 Samuel and gather that the establishment promised by the Lord was that of a house, a family, a descent of blood from David unto his children and his children's children. Used to blast stumps from fields, dynamite is an aid to the farmer. Used in war, it kills and maims. Fire cooks food and makes steam for engines. Fire also burns houses and destroys forests. But it is not the power, but the use of power, which is good or bad. The truth applies to any power, spiritual, legal, monarchical, political, or personal. Power is without either virtue or vice. The user may use it, well or ill, as he pleases. Freemasonry passes the brother in the process of becoming a fellow craft between the pillar of strength, power, and the pillar of establishment, choice or control. He is a man, now, and no minor or infant. He has grown up Masonically. Before him are spread the two great essentials to all success, all greatness, and all happiness. Like any other power, temporal or physical, religious or spiritual, Freemasonry can be used well or ill. Here is the lesson set before the fellowcraft. If he, like David, would have his kingdom of Masonic manhood established in strength, he must pass between the pillars with understanding that power without control is useless, and control without power is futile. Each is a complement of the other. In the passage between the pillars of the fellowcraft, not only has his feet set upon the winding stairs, but is given, so he has eyes to see and ears to hear, secret instructions as to how he shall climb those stairs, that he may indeed reach the middle chamber. He is to climb by strength, but directed by wisdom. He is to progress by power, but guided by control. He must rise by the might that is in him, but arrive by the wisdom of his heart. So considered, the inaccuracies and misstatements of ritual regarding the pillars become relatively unimportant, whether 18 or 35 cubits high, whether cast in one place or another, whether or not surmounted in Solomon's day with globes terrestrial and celestial, matter little. The lesson is there, the meaning of the symbol to be read. The initiate of old saw in the obelisk the very spirit of God that he worshipped. The modern Masonic initiate may see in the two pillars the means by which he may travel a little further, a little higher toward the secret middle chamber of life, in which dwells the unseen presence. All right, that is the end of that paper. You know, several times during the paper, I wanted to stop and then give some additional context, but I think the author does a great job specifically speaking about some of the elements back in 1935 that are only now starting to come out, but it's also really, really important to hold some of the statements to the flame of truth, historical truth, and I think this author really does that. I find nothing wrong with what he's saying, and I think if we take the lessons of the pillars as he presents it toward the end of the paper, that's a really good set of instructions. Of course, my mind dwells on the further esoteric and symbolic interpretations, whether that's Kabbalistic or what have you. But again, many different paths, same goal. There's many men out there who decide that they want to bounce from Freemasonry to Golden Dawn to Theosophy or to OTO, and they belong to all these organizations. I belong to a few myself. And I think some are under the ailment that by joining these different orders, they will somehow gain power or influence or bragging rights, and others might bounce from system to system looking for the answer. But the key, actually, is if you belong to multiple organizations, that hopefully you're seeing different ways to the same answer, and maybe they will assist you from time to time in traversing some portion of what you're trying to figure out that speaks to you in an easier way. Maybe Theosophy explains one element of a concept related to the revelation, we'll call it, better than, say, Freemasonry. Maybe Freemasonry does it better than the Golden Dawn or Boda or one of these other systems. In an esoteric or wisdom school kind of way, we look at things like the pillars and for whatever lesson they're teaching us and how that's relevant to the core truth of what we're all after, the absolute reality, as Hinduism calls it. In any case, I hope you enjoyed this episode. It was a lot of fun. It's our second episode of 2020. It sounds so futuristic, and yet here we are, still searching. So I hope you all have a wonderful week. Thank you very much to all of our supporters and contributors and fellows. We cannot do this without you. Please check out our show links. Please check out the bookstore. Buy some books. Go through our links. Use the coupon codes. Sign up over at Intellectual Linear Progression to be on the next wave of folks coming through the program. I will confirm with you right now, we're going to have Angel Millar on the program here in the next few weeks, so look forward to that as well. And until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.